In the 1970s, NHL mayhem wasn't just tolerated, it was sold as entertainment. Those certifiable lunatics ran wild, instigating bench-clearing brawls, wild melees, and drawing rivers of bad blood. But even in that chaos, one madman stood apart, not just the meanest or most unhinged, but the most dangerous. A maniac teammates feared, opponents hated, and law enforcement came to know all too well. This is the story of the most insane player of hockey's most insane era. The hooligan for whom the penalty box would prove to be a prelude to prison. Born in Toronto, Ontario, December 12, 1951, Steve Durbano grew up with hockey all around him. He lived next door to future Maple Leafs and Blackhawks star Jim Pappin, and across the street from Maple Leafs legend Bob Pulford. His father, Nick, was a successful real estate executive who also owned different junior teams at various levels. And he also owned a legendary temper. Boyhood friend and Hockey Hall of Famer Steve Shutt describes the relationship between father and son as, quote, poison. It wasn't the best relationship, and you could see where he got his temper from, Shutt said. His father pushed him relentlessly. Perhaps the first inkling of what was to be for Durbano in hockey came when he was just 12 years old. His father was coaching the team Steve was on and was yelling at the squad when the son came up with a wisecrack. Steve said, I wasn't close enough for him to slug me, so he whipped the puck at me and hit me on the side of the head. 2 years later, Durbano, now 50 pounds heavier and 10 inches taller, beat up his dad in an infamous locker room fight. Steve Durbano quit school at age 17, played on his father's junior B team in Hamilton, Ontario, and took a job sweeping floors at Toronto's Maple Leaf Gardens. I didn't think I needed an education, he recalled. I was going to make my fortune in hockey. In 1969, Nick Durbano traded Steve to the OHA Toronto Marlboros, and he quickly earned a reputation as the league's premier bad boy, leading the league in penalty minutes with 371 in 53 games in 69-70, and 324 minutes in just 49 games in 70-71. Durbano embraced the role of protector to the Marlies' numerous star players like Steve Shutt, Mark Howe, Dave Gardner, Dale Talon, and Steve Vickers. Durbano was talented, but he was best known for a series of troubling incidents, including assaulting a police officer in St. Catharines, Ontario. After slapping Steve with a 10-game suspension, exasperated OHA president Tubby Schmaltz said, quote, we have to do something to get this boy back on the right track and get him set for professional hockey. As Steve Shutt recalls, quote, I don't know how many rinks we'd drive away from and have to go pick up Steve from jail. We'd play, he'd get arrested, well, we get used to that. Durbano had size at 6 feet 1, 210 pounds, a hard shot, and was a solid hitter. And of course, he was intimidating. And those qualities led the New York Rangers to draft him in round one, 13th overall in the 1971 NHL draft. He played the entire 71-72 season in Omaha of the Central League, amassing a league record 407 penalty minutes. In the spring of 1972, Durbano, along with a handful of Omaha teammates, was called up the Rangers' playoff run. Remember, they went to the finals against the Bruins in 72. He never played a shift, but for 6 wild weeks, he dove headfirst into the Manhattan party scene, developing a taste for nightlife, chaos, and increasingly exotic substances. In that brief window, Steve Durbano had already begun the scripting of his downfall that would define him. His risky behavior extended to that offseason, when he'd make the first of 5 illegal contraband trips to South America in return for $5,000, a sum that was appealing to him because he was only making $9,000 at the time. Now, curiously, at the conclusion of the playoffs, the Rangers traded Durbano to the St. Louis Blues for future considerations, which turned out to be Kurt Bennett and Peter McDuff. It didn't take long for the man called Demolition Derby to leave his mark as a Blue.
It's loose in front. O'Reilly couldn't get a poke at it. He's knocked down by Durbano. They go at it. Oh, Durbano swung his stick, and it just missed the head of Terry O'Reilly. O'Reilly battling him again. Durbano on top of him. O'Reilly comes back on top of him.
Later in the season, when he was taunted by the Philadelphia Flyers trainer, Durbano raced across the ice and speared him in the mouth, knocking out two teeth and cutting him for 8 stitches. That incited a bench-clearing brawl with the Flyers. Durbano continued to display erratic behavior, even with his own team. Now, once leaving the Blues in the first period of a game with the New York Rangers, he took a penalty for hooking in the first 9 seconds of the game, and the Rangers scored on the ensuing power play. Now, after Durbano left the penalty box, head coach Jean-Guy Talbot kept him on the bench for a couple of shifts. Later in the period, Talbot instructed Durbano to take the point position on the Blues' power play. Durbano hesitated, then climbed over the boards, skated to the corner of the rink, and told a startled usher to open the gate leading to the Blues' dressing room. Durbano showered, dressed, and was gone. Now, he was suspended, and team owner Sidney Solomon III wanted him gone. But his teammates, led by Bob and Barkley Plager, took a vote and convinced ownership to give him another chance. But later in the season, however, Durbano missed multiple practices, and the Blues had finally reached their limit. On January 17, 1974, he was traded by the Blues with Ab DeMarco and Bob Battleship Kelly to the Pittsburgh Penguins for a second-round draft pick in 1974, Greg Poulos and Brian Watson. With the Broad Street bully Philadelphia Flyers on the rise, Penguins beefed up the muscle with Durbano and Kelly, who was one of the best fighters of the era. Both were immediate hits with the Civic Arena fans, and Durbano played excellent hockey for the Penguins, logging an impressive +17 plus-minus rating in just 33 games. The Penguins and GM Ren Blair were so enamored with Durbano that they signed him to an incredible 11-year contract worth $1.32 million. However, Steve would only see a fraction of that money. The 1974-75 season was off to a typical Durbano start. In an exhibition game versus the WHA Cleveland Crusaders, Durbano knocked out Jerry Pinder with an elbow and set off a bench-clearing brawl that was so outrageous, Cleveland coach John Hanna pulled his team from the ice and conceded the game. Durbano had previously been suspended for the first 2 games of the Penguin season due to a stick-swinging incident on September 25th, so he made his season debut in Game 3 versus the Philadelphia Flyers. Just 90 seconds into the game, he was assessed a 10-minute misconduct. When he returned to the ice, he'd take his last fully healthy shift in pro hockey.
I don't know. We were playing Philadelphia, and I was trying hard to avoid a hip check by Moose DuPont. I put my hand out, and when I hit the ice, my elbow was locked. Now, that impact, I pushed a bone right from my arm through my hand. The pain was unbelievable. When I pulled my glove off, I gotta tell you, I almost got sick. The doctor had a player sit in my arm while I yanked my hand back into place.
There were 5 operations on the hand, but nerve damage and scar tissue left him with the use of only 2 fingers. That injured hand had begun to atrophy. His once powerful punches and booming slapshot were gone forever. What remained was his belligerence. He said, "The timing was terrible. I felt like my game was just coming together." Durbano's career decline accelerated in the 1975-76 season. His comeback from the injury was slow. His play and his attitude deteriorated. The demons that drove him were starting to take over. He wasn't just reckless. He was dangerous. After continually butting heads with head coach Mark Boileau, Durbano earned his ticket out of the Steel City. On January 9, 1976, he was traded by the Penguins with first-round draft pick in the 1976 draft. It turned out to be Paul Gardner and Chuck Arneson to the Kansas City Scouts for first-round draft pick in 1976, which was Blair Chapman, Eddie Gilbert, and Simon Nolle. The Scouts were a miserable, losing lot, playing before small crowds in their final year of NHL hockey in Kansas City. Now, how bad were the Scouts? They concluded their season with 1 win in their last 44 games and a 27-game winless streak. But they did have a player who topped the league in 1 statistic, Steve Durbano, with 376 penalty minutes. Durbano summed up the Scout situation this way, quote, "Jesus Christ and his disciples couldn't help this team. This team stinks." An interesting factoid, it turns out the Scouts weren't quite done at the conclusion of the 75-76 regular season. They had a 4-game exhibition tour to play the Washington Capitals in Japan in mid-April. Apparently, Durbano arrived in Japan with his usual pregame prep. Teammate Chuck Arneson tells of a tale that when the scout's plane landed in Sapporo, Japan, Durbano forgot his shaving kit on the plane and was in a panic before racing through the terminal and back on the plane to recover it and its valuable contents, which may or may not have included shaving gear. Japanese fans were sold on potential mayhem in this series, and Durbano didn't disappoint, throwing his stick at a referee in Game 1 and getting into multiple fights with Washington's Blair Stewart in Game 3. Now, the Scouts became the Colorado Rockies in 1976, and new GM Ray Myron said there is no way that team was honoring Durbano's 11-year contract.
Well, my contract guaranteed me 5 years, about $490,000. When I got to Colorado, they told me they'd pay me, but that I'd never play another game unless I agreed to a new contract without the guarantees. Well, like an idiot, I signed a 3-year contract for $280,000 with no guarantees. So I guess I was more interested in seeing my name up in lights, you know, rather than making lots of money. I don't know. Like I said before, I wasn't too smart, and the guy was supposed to be looking out for me, Alan Eagleson. Oh, he sure as hell wasn't much smarter either.
When Durbano lost that contract, he reacted by intensifying his substance abuse, often crossing a line where few players ever did. On the ice, he continued to wreak havoc. Durbano was demoted to the AHL Rhode Island Reds at midseason and was the center of never-ending chaos for 9 games before he quit the team. He returned to the ice for a brief training camp fling with the Detroit Red Wings in 1978. Aggressive hockey was back in town, and who'd be a better fit than Durbano? Toronto Star columnist Rosie DiMano recalls that at One Wings practice, an angry Durbano suddenly picked her out of a sparse crew of reporters and threw his stick at her like a spear. She ducked, the Wings apologized, and Derby was soon traded to the WHA Birmingham Bulls along with slapshot movie star Dave Killer Hansen for Vaclav Nedimansky and Tim Sheehy in a rare interleague deal. At this point, Durbano was admittedly completely out of control. On a team that would put Hansen's fictional slapshot team to shame, the Bulls now boasted the four horsemen of hockey hitmen: Durbano, Hansen, Gilles Bad News Bilodeau, and Frank Seldom Beaton. Each of this notorious quartet accumulated over 200 penalty minutes, with Durbano pacing the pack with a league-leading 284. Here's a brief sample of Demolition Derby, WHA style.
And Rutkowski drops the stick and gloves, and here's Terry Rutkowski landing a right on Durbano and another right. Rutkowski flailing away with the right hand. Now the linesmen move in and try to separate Durbano and Rutkowski. Now Durbano throws a right hand, hits the linesman, hits him again. In they go to the ice. Now the linesmen try to pry Durbano and Rutkowski apart. As we told you, those linesmen have a tough job, and they're trying to pry apart a couple of hard-nosed competitors here. Terry Rutkowski, the Arrows, and Steve Durbano are the Bulls, and now Rutkowski lands a right hand as they get loose. Now Durbano has a hold of Rutkowski's sweater, trying to get it over his head. The linesmen trying to pry Durbano and Rutkowski apart, have them partially separated. And now they're totally separated, and we're going to be getting more penalties here as Steve Durbano and Terry Rutkowski.
Fight started. Just when it looked like the players would sort out the problem, defenseman Steve Durbano charged from the bench and blindsided Bobby Hull to trigger a bench-clearing brawl, something the WHA cities have grown accustomed to as the league slowly destroys itself.
Something is antagonizing Durbano down there. He's being held off by Alan Glassbell. And here he goes after Morrison in the penalty box. Durbano going after Kevin Morrison, being held back by two, by Ron Harrison. The linesman, another linesman hops in the penalty box to watch Morrison. Durbano, he takes a swing at Morrison. And he takes another swing, he's pulling at Morrison's jersey. What's going to hit him? Durbano's going crazy out there. Somebody's going to get a hold of Durbano. He's still swinging at Morrison. And now Morrison drops him in the right hand. Kevin Morrison drops Durbano.
Dave Hansen told TSN once of a time he walked into the dressing room prior to a Bulls game against the New England Whalers and Gordie Howe. We noticed that Durbano was filing the blade of his stick to a sharp point. And when Hansen asked why, he basically said, "I'm getting ready for the old man. I'm going to get him tonight," said Durbano. Now, Durbano's time at Birmingham, he at various times threatened to break the legs of head coach, or actually assistant coach, John Brophy over a payment dispute, was sent home to deal with his wife, who had called at 3 a.m., found that he wasn't in his hotel room, and left a message with Frank Mihalovic to tell Steve that she was going to basically exterminate his dog and throw all his clothes away and destroy his house. I don't know if he was successful in that. There's another time you saw the brawl with Winnipeg in the previous clip, but there was another time that he caused a disturbance and the Winnipeg fans were waiting for him outside the dressing room, and he get into a brawl, as it so happens. Most of his teammates were in the shower, either fully unclothed or partially so. They run out to help Durbano. So there's the scene that Glenn Sonmore talks about in his book, where you have about seven or eight naked Birmingham Bulls hockey players fighting in the hallway outside the Jets locker room in Winnipeg, only in the WHA, I guess. There's another time, you know, Mark Howe relates this story in his book, where they were playing the New England Whalers, and Steve had a fight with Jack Carlson. Carlson, of course, one of the best ever, got the best of him. They come out later. Harry Neal sends him after Jack Carlson after Durbano again, get into another fight. Durbano loses big time to Jack Carlson. So the game goes on. Harry Neal, the coach of New England, wants Carlson to go out there and fight Durbano again. Carlson hops on the ice. As it so happens, the Whalers scored a goal. Durbano then goes to fish the puck out of the net. And when he does that, he fires it at the head of referee Bill Friday, who ducks and then throws Durbano out of the hockey game. Durbano then taunts Jack Carlson on the way out, basically saying, "You got me twice, but you can't get me a third time." And that kind of sums up where Steve was at that stage of his career. Everything was a sideshow, and it was just a crazy time that would probably get even crazier going forward. Here's how Birmingham goalie John Cheech Garrett remembers Steve from the WHA Bulls.
"Well, you know, Steve was right on the edge of wacko all the time. He could skate and he could shoot, but he'd just as soon hit you over the head with his stick. I really believe he wanted to be known as an outcast."
Now, due to that injury, with his right hand very much impaired, Steve had long abandoned being a pure or honorable fighter.
"Hey, as long as I'm concerned, you got that stick in your hand, you got the great equalizer. Hey, why drop it? If you get three or four guys coming at you, take it and whack one of them. Hey, you know they'd give it to you."
After four suspensions and the threat of a lifetime ban, Durbano was done in Dixie. But he was back in the NHL a year later. He signed as a free agent with his former team, the St. Louis Blues, for the 78-79 season. But he contracted hepatitis at training camp, a result of his substance abuse. Now, once he recovered, he broke his right hand on a punching bag and missed several weeks. And when he returned, it wasn't long before he got into trouble. During a game at Madison Square Garden, he would essentially make an unforgettable exit from the world of pro hockey.
"Nicky is a, as you know by this time, a Staten Island product, New York City born and bred. As the great New York City accent. Here comes Durbano. He's going for Mateo. He broke loose. Durbano out of no place suddenly went across the ice for no reason at all.
Mateo hit him with a left hand. As the coach getting into
it. Durbano on the bottom. Mateo's trying to pull him apart. Vincent Durbano was all over.
Jim, he's got a history of that kind of action. He's been suspended in every league he has played in at one time or another.
Durbano wants to come back again.
Durbano is going to the dressing room.
And moons the crowd.
And so is Mateo. And they better have a cop between them. They better have somebody in the hallway.
Some of the Rangers are going after
Mr. Nick into the dressing room, and so go some of the St. Louis Blues.
In the following September, Dubano lasted just 48 hours in the Blues' 1979 training camp and was released. The Demolition Derby was officially over. His final tally, 1,127 penalty minutes in 220 NHL games. His 5.12 average penalty minutes per game is by far and away the highest total in NHL history. As we'll see next, the chaos didn't end when Steve Dubano left the ice. In fact, it escalated. He had blown through every dollar he'd earned in the National Hockey League, and with hockey in the rearview mirror, he faced a grim question. What now? And Dubano found his answer. Not in business, not in coaching, but in illicit transport of contraband via South America. On January 26, 1981, Dubano made his fifth and what proved to be his final trip to Bolivia. On the return trip, he made it past customs in Miami, but his luck ran out on February 7, 1981, when he was arrested at Toronto International Airport and accused of trying to carry over 474 grams of illegal substances through customs inside of his shoes. He pleaded not guilty to importing and possession of narcotics for the purpose of resale. In 1983, Dubano's case went to trial, and he was found guilty and sentenced to 7 years in Canadian prison without implicating any of his cohorts.
Yeah, sure, there are other people involved, but hey, I'm not going to be a rat. You know, I don't want to worry about someone jumping me from behind or a bunch of guys coming at me from the front. Hey, I'd rather do my 7 years and walk out rather than be carried out.
Between the time of his 1981 arrest and his sentencing, Dubano endured 23 months in limbo. He worked on construction jobs, did a lot of drinking, separated from his wife, and met a woman who became pregnant. He worked for 16 months at a Toronto restaurant and was runner-up at a bartender's competition. Sitting in prison, Dubano was still bitter he never received compensation after suffering that serious wrist injury in 1974.
I don't know. They said I'd have to file for permanent disability within 30 days of the injury, but I was still having surgery 4 months later. It was supposed to be fully guaranteed by the league, but hey, their attitude was, go ahead and sue us. Now, what was I going to do? I was beginning to put my lawsuit together, and then I got busted. So all my money went to paying the lawyer for my trial, and that was it.
Dubano was released to a Toronto halfway house in 1984. He took up a trade in, perhaps fittingly, a slaughterhouse. He later worked construction jobs. Although he was now off powder and pills, he was drinking heavily. His liver was now damaged by the booze and another bout with hepatitis. But he continued to drink, stating, quote, I needed something to numb the pain. At one point, he was managing one of his dad's golf courses, and his life seemed to be improving. But when his marriage ended in 1990, he went back to chemical escapes, and in 1991, he was caught shoplifting in Toronto's Eaton Centre. Now he stated, quote, I thought I was stealing fancy shirts. They turned out to be pajama tops. And that gives you a pretty good idea of what shape my brain was in. He pleaded guilty and was sentenced to 5 days in jail. In 1998, Dubano pleaded guilty to attempting to hire an undercover police officer to work for his adult services scheme. The Crown sent him to jail for 3 months. Now, once released, Dubano was now living on a hockey pension of just $300 a month. My life's a mess, he told a reporter. If I went to bed tonight and never woke up, that wouldn't be such a bad thing. He eventually made his way to Alberta to visit an ex-wife and two daughters he hadn't seen in years. He ended up getting a job at a janitorial company, and that took him north to Yellowknife Northwest Territories, where he started a carpet cleaning business. He said, this is the best thing to ever happen to me. I just wish I was going to have more time. Dubano would reveal that he had cancer of the liver and cirrhosis of the liver. He needed an organ transplant, but because he refused to quit drinking, he was not considered to be a priority candidate for that procedure. The wild ride of Steve Dubano came to an end on November 10, 2002. The aforementioned Toronto Star columnist Rosie Dumano, whom Dubano once threatened from his jail cell after a critical article she wrote, memorialized Dubano by stating, quote, it's considered to be bad form to speak ill of the dead. but in that case, there would be little to say about Durbano. She concluded her nasty diatribe by summing up Durbano as, quote, a psychopath and a thug. His teammates were more charitable. Mike Murphy stated, quote, he was the most raucous player I've ever seen, like a character right out of Slapshot. You think these guys were invented? You didn't know Steve Durbano. He scared me when I played with him and against him. But he was very likable, funny, friendly, and genuine. But he used his stick in vile ways. And former junior teammate Dale Talon added, he was a good-hearted guy who made bad decisions. He was a little crazy, but more than that, he was fearless. It's good to be fearless in hockey, but I just don't know if you can live that way. What an incredible story. The story of Steve Durbano, and it's the story I've wanted to tell for a long time. Glad I finally had the opportunity to do that. In the comments section below, which I consider to be a real piece of history in itself, we got great viewers with a lot of knowledge. So share your stories of Steve Durbano, your impressions, if you never saw him play, of Steve, based on what you saw here in this video, and your general overall comments about his career and his life. Meanwhile, check out this video from another legend of hockey's golden era.
Now the linesmen move in and try to separate Durbano and Rostowski. Now Durbano throws a right hand, hits the linesman, hits him again. In they go to the ice.